Blog Talk Radio.
We want to thank everyone for tuning in tonight to Blog Talk Radio for Friday, June the 27th, 2014. We are Answers for the Paranormal, and my name is Bill Posey. I'm the host of this broadcast this evening, and with me on the line over in Horsham, Pennsylvania, and the county seat of Montgomery County is my co-host Joe Marotti. What's going on tonight, Joe?
There's a lot going on tonight, Bill. We're about to wrap up a very, very long look into Sandy Hook as it happened back in 12, 14, 12. We've got so much ground to cover tonight, and we've done so much research regarding this topic. It's almost like an anticlimax, but that term really doesn't sit well with me, because there is so much material that we're not going to be able to cover tonight that I've researched, and as well as other researchers I've also uncovered. So tonight is an attempt by us to wrap up something that seems like it's unwrappable unless it's actually exposed as a lie. So we have so much to cover tonight. So I'm really anxious to get to it.
Yeah, I am too, brother. And, you know, as I stated, in our previous show 1 week ago, never in my wildest imagination would I ever had envisioned Sandy Hook and this subject of what happened there in December of 2012. Never thought that we would get through to six episodes. And you know what, Joe? It just seems as though from where we started and to where we've come to today, the amount of information and the, you know, apparent discrepancies and failures on the parts of law enforcement, and let's not forget the failures on the part of media.
Right.
You know, it just has become this kind of monster to where it's difficult to be able to get out everything that, you know, you've found through research. So, as you say, we're going to put this to rest after tonight. We titled this show tonight, Sandy Hook on Trial, the Final Chapter. And that's our intention, is to make this the final chapter in this series that we've done. So, Joe, I'm really glad that we were able to come on tonight and didn't have to delay it any further. And,
right.
You know, it's been taxing at times, and at other times it's been exhilarating as you find new information out and uncover things. And, you know, I'm really anxious to hear what you have to bring tonight. So, with that, Joe, why don't we get right into what we want to talk about tonight? Now, last week when we were wrapping up the broadcast, Joe and I were right in the middle of giving the gospel presentation, and I commented to Joe when I re-listened to the broadcast, it was amazing that the last words that came out of Joe's mouth was a scripture passage that without the shedding of blood, there is no remission for sin. And it was with that the broadcast ended. But actually, we had 2 minutes on the clock, and
right.
for whatever reason, the show ended 2 minutes early, and so we wanted to get back to that last part of what Joe what he wanted to say in regards
right.
to that scripture passage. So Joe, why don't you pick it up there?
Right, I will do that, Bill. And even before that, let me say that I know that many Christians slash believers are afraid to hint at the reality of demonic interference in the spreading of the gospel. But I don't think that we have ever in any of our broadcasts shied away from exposing the devil and his workers as those who would hinder the furtherance of the gospel. Let me suggest and actually submit that I believe there's no question that the devil is at work in trying to prevent the preaching of the gospel and the furtherance of the gospel in any way that he can. And so that when we, in any of our blog talk radio broadcasts, whether it be the topic be ghosts or aliens or any other topic, whether it be Sandy Hook, he will have his workers engaged specifically in the area of technology to alter it and to stop it. So I'm not embarrassed or afraid in any way to say that. It's ridiculous to even suggest it. The demons aren't able to affect technology. It's absolutely absurd. The fact that today's cowardly church, quote unquote, refuses to address that topic, that demons are at work in any way that they can to stop the preaching of the gospel, is just ridiculous. Having said that, I absolutely indict demonic workers as far as not being able to finish the gospel last time, but the Lord has workers that are persistent, and let us be those who are persistent. So tonight I will pick up where I left off last time, Bill, as I was saying, and this is found in the book of Hebrews. The writer of Hebrews says this in chapter 9, verse 27, just as man is destined to die once, and that is physically, and after that to face judgment. So Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many people, and he will appear a second time, not to bear sin, but to bring salvation to those who are waiting for him.
Mm-hmm.
And continues on in chapter 10, and this is what I want to focus on here very quickly. The law is only a shadow of good things that are coming, not the reality themselves. For this reason, it can never, by the same sacrifices repeated endlessly year after year, make perfect those who draw near to worship. If it could, would they not have stopped being offered? For the worshipers would have been cleansed once for all and would no longer have felt guilty for their sins. But those sacrifices are an annual reminder of sins, because it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. Therefore, when Christ came into the world, he said, sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but a body you prepared for me. With burnt offerings and sin offerings you were not pleased. Then I said, here am I. It is written about me in the scroll, come to do your will, O God. So Jesus is saying here that the year after year priestly offerings, where the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies with blood to cover his sins as well as the sins of those who were Israelites, was not sufficient. And that the fact that they had to do it year after year was a testimony that they were not placed as far as the east is from the west, as we're told, but that a reminder that sins need to be covered year after year after year until the coming of Christ, when by his sacrifice, once and for all, the atonement made once and for all, by the shedding of the blood of the Lamb of God, who was Jesus Christ himself, by the shedding of his blood, not the shedding of blood of lambs and goats, which we're told here in Hebrews, was not pleasing to God, but the but what was pleasing to him and what was sufficient for the payment of sins. And this is the key, once and for all, so that no further sacrifice is needed or required or possible, but that the shedding of the blood of the Son of God was sufficient to pay for the sins of the world for all who have ever lived in all time in the history of man. By the shedding of the blood of Jesus Christ, placing your faith in that shed blood, that man has forgiveness for sin once and for all, so that no further sacrifice is needed, no further good works are needed, no good works are possible to gain salvation, but that it is by faith that we have been saved through the shed blood of Jesus Christ, through the finished work of Jesus Christ, the atonement made once and for all. It's a very, you know, I've just used a lot of words, but it's really simple. Jesus came to do what no man could ever do, or no animal could ever do, the blood of no animal could ever do, and that is to pay the sin debt that man owes, because all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, the perfect requirement of God, holiness, utter holiness. No man could be utter holy outside of Jesus Christ, so that we have all sinned and come short of his glory, so that we're all guilty before him. That reality presented itself as condemnation towards us, so that Jesus bore that wrath, paid that penalty once and for all on Calvary's cross, so that it is by faith, and God knows the heart and the mind. Do you really believe? You know, people say Jesus this and God that all the time.
Yeah.
But God knows the heart. God knows the mind. He knows who is really, really, truly believing that Jesus paid the debt that he couldn't pay, the individual. So really, that is the gospel, that man is a separated sinner, guilty, deserving of hell and eternal punishment in the lake of fire, as we read of in the book of Revelation, but that doesn't need to happen. But that's through finished faith in the finished work of Jesus Christ on the cross. You don't have to spend eternity in judgment in the lake of fire, but you spend eternity in paradise, as Jesus said to the thief on the cross, "Today you will be with me in paradise." What did the thief do? He didn't do anything other than confess with his lips and believe in his heart that Jesus is the Son of God. The thief on the cross had no works to claim before God other than faith that the man who was being crucified with him was the Son of God, and that by this death, that this thief could be with Jesus in paradise, because those were Jesus' own words. So we have a glorious promise and a wonderful hope in Jesus Christ. So in all of the ugliness and the darkness, and man, I'm telling you, it is the devil's playground up there in Newtown, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
The overarching reality is that people don't have to be stuck in that darkness. They don't have to be lost and groping in that darkness, Bill. But it is through simple childlike faith. Yes, Lord, I believe that you sent Jesus into the world, not to condemn the world, but that through him, the world might be saved. So it's with that in mind that we proceed from here on to Sandy Hook.
Yeah, amen. Thanks, Joe. And you know, the what Joe just described there, the Bible states that when one does place their faith in Christ, that they are transferred out of the kingdom of darkness, and that's what Joe just alluded to, and into the kingdom of light. So with that, we would like to give that invitation to anyone who has heard the gospel here tonight and has been convicted in their heart that they are guilty sinners and that they deserve judgment and the wrath of God. But through faith and through confession with their lips and belief in their heart, that they would be transferred out of darkness and into the kingdom of light And the Bible calls that salvation. So we extend that to everyone listening who have never done that. Won't you consider tonight placing your faith in Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of your sins and for eternal life that he gives freely to everyone who believes.
Amen.
All right, Joe. We want to get into our icebreaker segment of the broadcast tonight. And this is where we open up with some dialogue and get the juices flowing, so to speak, before we tackle what we want to talk about tonight. So, Joe, you want to go first, or you want me to read mine first for you?
I'll go first.
All right, that sounds good.
Okay, brother, here we go. Bill, while it is clear to see that the people of this country and of the world are so emotionally invested with frivolous things such as the World Cup and the Super Bowl, and not the real news events that matter and have profound and lasting impacts on ourselves as individuals as well as nations, why take the time to produce, you said six, I think it's seven, Bill. Seven Sandy Hook broadcasts, knowing that people are really predisposed to news which bears no real relevancy or meaning. So why take the time to produce seven Sandy Hook broadcasts? Really, you could translate this into our other broadcasts as well when we talk about ghosts or aliens or the church. Why take the time, specifically for tonight, why take the time to produce seven Sandy Hook broadcasts when you know that the world is inclined to listen to things that really don't matter? Doesn't it seem like a waste of time? So why? Why are we doing what we're doing?
Yeah, I think, you know what, oftentimes I've thought on that myself. And, you know, it's... You know, you think back to, or at least I do. I think back to what it was like for God's prophets. You know, when they were given clear instruction from the Lord to go and to speak to the nation of Israel, who had involved themselves in so many things, among them idol worship. And turning away from the Lord and following down the path of destruction, and God would instruct his prophets to go and to tell Israel the truth about what they were doing, and that if they would turn again to him, if they would repent, that that he would continue to bless them, and they would bring them back into relationship with him, because as we know from the Bible, God is a jealous God. He doesn't want to share his glory or his love with any other. And so that was the purpose of God sending his prophets. Now, understand, I'm in no way saying that Joe and I are prophets sent by God, but in the same way, you know, we look at things through a biblical lens, and we see things happening that the scriptures talk about, and you know, at some point we'll come to future fruition. And you know, even Jesus told his disciples to discern the signs of the time, you know, look for the signs of his soon return. And you know, it's with that in mind that we analyze things that are going on. And You know, I'm sure many of God's prophets lamented, you know, that Israel, the nation, was an obstinate people who refused to turn back to God. And it's very much like today. You know, and as you stated, Joe, the you know, the frivolousness of what's available for people, from you know, what the Kardashians are doing to sport, to entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much, and even the news, Joe.
Yes.
You know, what is perceived as news today is so distracting, and you know, it just leads people into an area of lethargy and really not caring to know the truth about anything.
That's right.
And you know, call it what you want, but I believe that there's the reason that we've done 7 broadcasts on this topic is that there's a restlessness that that we experience. You know, we're constantly being prodded by the Holy Spirit to continue to expose this darkness that is, as you described it, Joe, that is Sandy Hook.
Right.
And I believe that we haven't been able to rest. And
mm-hmm.
quite frankly, as more and more of the information became available for us, such as this report from Connecticut State Attorney and the appendix that goes along with it, as those and the 911 calls and, you know, what the officials, both police and government officials up in Connecticut, what they thought was the final verdict on what happened, really just opened up a further
yes.
can of worms for them, because there's even more questions now that they can't answer.
That's right.
And instead of putting to rest what happened on 12/14/12, it is really exploded with more inconsistencies, more questions that need to be answered. And, you know, it's a long-winded way of getting to this point, and that's that we need to continue to do these until the truth comes out. And so that's why we're on broadcast number 7 today.
Yeah, I don't think that was long. To me, long-winded means that you said a lot of things that didn't make any sense. I think you used enough words, Bill, to make much sense. Yes, there's no question that the reason that we're doing 7 broadcasts is that, number one, the truth hasn't come out regarding – the truth hasn't been revealed. It hasn't been exposed regarding Sandy Hook. And so with researchers such as yourself and myself and many others as well, the work continues. But even overarching all of that, Bill, is that for believers in Jesus Christ and those who hold dear the Word of God, the truth, as we will continue to preach and to announce, is above all the opinions of men, and it is the truth above all to be honored. So mm-hmm. we don't believe that we believe in our hearts that we've arrived at a partiality of the truth, in that what we were told happened on 12/14/12 did not happen. But as far as what actually did happen, we do not believe that we ourselves as well as the United States of America, as well as the world, have received the truth regarding that day. Do we know that that will ever happen? I don't know for sure, but my sense is that we're getting close to disclosure that it wasn't really a situation where a mass murder took place. But I think that you said well in summing it up, Bill, basically in that it's a matter of really ultimately honoring the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So what have you got for me tonight, brother, as far as the icebreaker question?
Yeah, this segues very nicely into what I want to ask you. And it's this, Joe, when, and I'm going to emphasize the word when.
Mm-hmm.
When the truth about Sandy Hook is revealed,
mm-hmm.
what will your reaction be? Will it be one of confirmation, vindication, exhilaration, or all three?
There's no question, Bill, that it's going to be all three. Did you mention celebration in there?
No, but let's throw that in as well.
Okay. I'm not a drinker, but in the celebration of the revealing, now let's be clear in as to what that would include. That would entail the reality that it didn't really happen. It mm-hmm. would include the reality that those alleged debunkers, and I'll mention their names, C.W. Wade and Chris Hernandez, the author, if anybody out there would like to investigate or check out their alleged evidence that Sandy Hook really happened the way that we were told that it happened. It would also be a celebration of the as I've had correspondences with those two people, celebration of exposing those two people as they would be the reverse hoaxers, if you would allow me to say that.
Mm-hmm.
In that they're trying to debunk Sandy Hook quote unquote hoaxers. So if a full-fledged exposing of a lie regarding Sandy Hook would take place, people such as C.W. Wade and Chris Hernandez, the author, would be exposed as the people who were foolish enough to believe that that really happened, or even worse, that they were part and parcel, that they were shills, they were setups in order to get people to believe the official story. But and I've thought about this, but what would I really do? I would probably take a day to savor it, to check the headlines, to read everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you what, Bill, what would not follow very, very what would follow very, very shortly after that would be, how is America going to and how is the world going to respond to the reality that one of the leading, if not the leading nation of this global earth, has been involved and perpetrated a ruse that is as heinous, if not the most heinous, ruse ever perpetrated on mankind. When you're talking about 25, 6, 7-year-olds killed, how would they respond to? I would want the reaction to be a groundswell of people in the Washington D.C. area to rise up and actually storm the White House and remove Barack Obama and Eric Holder and whoever else would be responsible for this despicable lie, and to just take them out and lash them. That would be my response. that would have been my knee-jerk response, but I guess a more calculated response would be something that, to the effect that let's get them tried and let's get them convicted and let's get them imprisoned and let's get a new president. So my response is that it would be an extreme retaliation against those who perpetrated this, and really there's nothing less called for if this is revealed, if and when this is revealed as a hoax. You can't downplay it in any way. You just can't downplay it, Bill, because nothing like this has ever happened before. This is there's no precedent to this event if and when it's exposed as a hoax or an integrated coordinated event between multiple agencies. America, I don't even know if we know how to handle this, Bill. I mean, is it grounds for impeachment? You bet.
Mm-hmm.
You bet. I know that there are steps that have to be taken. You can't just go in and remove the president, as I've suggested. Would I like to see it? Yeah, I would. I'm a human being. But I'm also someone who wants to uphold law. We do have laws in place. So I would want to see those laws enforced. I would want to see people's heads roll legally. There would be an aftermath, Bill. There would be an aftermath. Because if this is revealed as a hoax, it's not isolated. You have to look at the Boston bombing. You have to look at Oklahoma City. You have to look at 9/11. And you have to know that if Sandy Hook is revealed as a hoax, then you have to reinvestigate all of those other national tragedies of terror that allegedly took place and see that they really took place the way we were told that they took place.
Mm-hmm.
So the ramifications and consequences are not isolated to the specifics of Sandy Hook. They would be broadened to reach back decades, but also, what about the next shooting that takes place?
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible to contemplate what the consequences of an event like this being hoaxed would be to the nation of America and really to the nation of the world. How can they be trusted? Really, it's incredible to even contemplate.
It is. All right, thanks, Joe. And I'd say that those two icebreaker questions just definitely got the juices flowing. So,
man, you got that right.
With that, we're going to get back to the Sadensky report. This is the official report filed by the Connecticut State Attorney's Office and the Connecticut State Attorney, Stephen J. Sadensky. And we've called it Sandy Hook on Trial, and we've been putting this document on trial for the past three broadcasts. So, Joe, you want to talk about where we're going to pick up on this report and continue to expose the utter inconsistencies and ridiculousness that's contained in this report?
Yeah, Bill, we're going to pick up on page 24. We left off on page 23 with the absurdity of H. Wayne Carver III, the chief medical examiner for the state of Connecticut, and his handling of the bodies within the alleged bodies within Sandy Hook Elementary School, and how that all played out, and just the you know, I can't find words anymore to describe how absurd what is explained here in the report and how we should just, they expect us to accept this hook, line, and sinker. So we're going to transition from H. Wayne Carver's episode up to page 24, where we now have the heading of 36 Yogananda Street, Newtown, Connecticut, incident and response. So again, we're going to pick up with me reading Mr. Sudensky's report and then commenting on it. And again, we're at 8:10, Bill, and we have until 10:30 again tonight.
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay.
That's correct.
So I'm going to go as quickly as I possibly can. And again, if at any time you need clarification or you want to ask a question, that might mean as well someone listening would also be thinking the same thing. So please do stop me at that time that you see that would be necessary. Again,
sure.
Page 24, the incident actually at 36 Yogananda Street in Newtown, Connecticut. These are the words of Stephen J. Sudensky, the state's attorney for the Judicial District of Danbury in Connecticut. Sometime on the morning of December 14th, 2012, before 9:30 a.m., the shooter shot and killed his mother, Nancy Lanza, in her bed at 36 Yogananda Street, Newtown. My comment to that is this. What is the evidence that Adam Lanza killed Nancy Lanza? Is the evidence, well, Adam Lanza's body was found at Sandy Hook Elementary School, and he killed everyone there, and his mother was found dead in their home that afternoon, so it had to be Adam, right? There were no witnesses. What's the physical evidence? Adam's fingerprints on the rifle? The rifle was alleged to have belonged to the Lanzas, so of course Adam's prints will be on the rifle. And even though the investigators have determined that Adam acted alone at Sandy Hook Elementary School, how can they be sure he didn't have an accomplice in the killing of his mother? Maybe he couldn't bring himself to kill his own mother and had to have someone else do it for him. This can't be ruled out, Bill. And the case against Adam Lanza in the killing of his mother is circumstantial at best. And it is totally irresponsible for Sudensky to state in this report, in fact, that Adam killed his mother.
Mm.
Continuing on with Sudensky's comment, with Sudensky's report here. The weapon used was a .22 caliber Savage Mark II rifle. Someone in the area reported hearing two or three gunshots in the neighborhood between 8 a.m. and 9 a.m. That person thought them to be from hunters, though the person indicated the shots did sound unusually close. Between 9:30 a.m. and 10 a.m., there was a delivery made to the house. The delivery driver saw no one, did not see any vehicles in the driveway, and the garage door was closed. A delivery slip was left, and the driver continued on. Comment to that is, were police dispatched to investigate this hearing of quote-unquote two or three gunshots?
Mm-hmm.
We have in this report the account of a delivery driver making a delivery to the Lanza house between 9:30 and 10, but no report of police sent out to investigate the hearing of shots. What happens in Newtown? You report hearing shots, so the police say, okay, the person calling must be hearing hunters, right? Is that what happens in Newtown? I don't know. I would think that a person calling, having lived in that area, would know, well, it's hunters. So why waste the police time? No, they thought that it was serious enough to call the police, and so therefore the police should have come out. But there's no indication that that took place here in the report. Moving on quickly.
I have a question for
you. Sure. Yeah.
You've been to 36 Yogananda Street.
That's right.
On one occasion, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now you're in that neighborhood, right? You're surrounded. Now I remember you telling me how close the houses were in that neighborhood.
Yes.
Okay. We have a report from a report that there was gunshots heard at the school.
Right.
And that report was that they thought it was hunters. And now in this neighborhood, we have the same thing. They thought it was hunters. Now, Joe, just driving around that area with you when I went with you to Newtown.
Yeah.
I don't recall seeing many areas where there would be active hunting going on. And in that neighborhood, how close would it have been to a wooded area where there would be hunting going on? It just seems to me as though it's too easy to just say, oh, yeah, it's hunters.
That's a great question, Bill. Without question, there's no possibility that anybody near the school would think that any gunshots heard would be hunters. There isn't anything close. With regards to 36 Yogananda, I can't say dogmatically that it's not possible to hear hunters shooting, okay? There is some sort of a reserve that is close to that area. Now, I don't know whether there is hunting that is allowed in this reserve or not, but even if there is, Bill, wouldn't you think that people would have gotten used to hearing gunshots? As I just
yeah,
said,
that's...
they would be used to hearing gunshots and thinking, well, why call the police? They're just hunters.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
and especially since the person who gives the testimony that he heard the shots, he says it sounded unusually close.
Correct.
So he was distinguishing between a muffled gunshot from a wooded area that may have been some distance away and the sound of a report coming from within that neighborhood. I would think, Joe, if you were in that neighborhood, you would know whether it was from a house or whether it was from a wooded area.
No question whatsoever, Bill. They would, unless someone just moved and they hear the shots the next day and they came from some urban area, that's not the indication here. Says here, someone in the area reported hearing two or three, quote-unquote, gunshots in the neighborhood between 8 a.m. and 9 a.m. That person thought them to be from hunters, but the person indicated that the shots did sound, quote-unquote, unusually close. So my problem is that if they – it doesn't say here that they reported it or they dialed 911. What does it mean that they reported hearing two? Who did they report this to? This is the absurd nature of Mr. Sedensky. I would like to know where Mr. Sedensky got his law degree from, because I want to go to that school because I want to stop struggling making ends meet and draw an attorney's paycheck, because it seems Mr. Sedensky, in his reporting here, has graduated from some Cracker Jack Institute where he doesn't have to be specific. He says here... Mm-hmm. Someone in the area reported. Now, that's a condemnation of the police. If you know that the difference between hearing a shot in the woods from a distance as opposed to hearing a shot in the neighborhood and the police don't come out, if the police did come out and it's not in this report, then it's a condemnation of Mr. Sedensky. So it's another area in this report that should piss people off. Good point. Moving on to page 25. And this is under the heading of 36 Yogananda Street, Newtown, Connecticut, scene investigation. The shooter's second floor bedroom windows were taped over with black trash bags. The second floor computer room also had its windows covered. There, investigators found a computer hard drive that appeared to have been intentionally damaged. To date, because of the extensive damage, forensic experts have not been able to recover any information from that hard drive. And my response, my comment to that is, if Adam Lanza knows he's going to die, Bill, that day, why would he care about what police would find on his computer hard drive? Why would he make it so hard to find? The only possibility that seems even remotely plausible is that he didn't want co-conspirators to be exposed. But again, this is only supposition. And as Mr. Sedensky has made painfully clear in this report, the shooter was a lone gunman. He acted alone, case closed. But let me just say that if Adam Lanza was attempting to protect co-conspirators, Bill, maybe one of those is the one who killed his mother for him. But then again, Mr. Sedensky has already declared Adam guilty in the killing of his mother. So let's move on. Really, it's that simple, Bill. The police say it's true. Newtown police say it's true. Connecticut State Police say it's true. The FBI say it's true. Stephen J. Sedensky says it's so. So why should anybody question it? I mean, let's just move on. They have the final say, it appears. In a typical criminal case, the investigation would remain open when potentially important evidence was still being examined. Given the improbability of any information being recovered from the damaged hard drive, this outstanding piece of evidence is not preventing the closure of this case now. Should any relevant information related to the existence of any accessory or co-conspirator be obtained from the hard drive, the case will be reopened. My question and comment is, it should be noted that the case may be reopened if anything is recovered from that hard drive, as Sedensky says. I don't know, Bill. Are they still working on that computer? Has any news release come out and said that authorities have determined that no further information, nothing can be gleaned from the hard drive of Adam Lanza's computer, so that is the end of that. I haven't heard that yet, so I just want to throw that out there. As far as I know, they might still be with their white coats on and their Coke bottle glasses looking at the hard drive of Adam Lanza's computer. And if you believe that, I do have some swamp land in Florida. Okay, moving on to page 26. Of Mr. Sedensky's report. While the vast majority of persons interviewed had no explanation for the shooter's actions, a review of electronic evidence or digital media that appeared to belong to the shooter revealed that the shooter had a preoccupation with mass shootings, in particular the Columbine shootings, and a strong interest in firearms. For example, there was a spreadsheet with mass murders over the years listing information about each shooting. My comment is this. This whole page is Sedensky's attempt to add 2 + 2, Bill. To have the reader here come to the conclusion, well, of course, now it's clear. It's all clear. Adam loved guns, and he was preoccupied with mass killings and violent video games. So there's the motive that they haven't been able to establish yet, right? Okay. And I'll tell you what, Bill, I don't care how this sounds. I really don't. If you, anybody that knows me, I don't care, really. Have police been guilty of planting evidence? Come on. That's a rhetorical question. Of course they have. How do you provide a motive we're here to for you have been utterly unable to, it comes down to a question of faith and trust. You have to just accept by faith that all of these items were found in Lonza's home. I'm sorry. I don't have that kind of blind faith in law enforcement. Please. And let me add this to the confusion, Bill. We've been given a picture of Lonza painted on this page as someone who has a morbid preoccupation with the suffering of others through violence. Let that sink into the mind of the hearer. Adam Lonza has been painted as someone who has a morbid preoccupation with the suffering of others through violence. Okay, so let me ask this. To my knowledge, Adam Lonza, prior to 12/14/12, had no criminal or juvenile record of violence, no arrests, no accusations against him, no school record of violence. At no time were police called to his home for any reason, no evidence of having been violent towards his mother, father, or brother, or anyone in the neighborhood, no record or evidence of violence towards animals. You go from a zero record of violence to killing 20 children and 7 adults. So how does this add up? How does that add up? If this guy has had a morbid preoccupation with violence and mass shootings and firearms, all of a sudden on 12/14/12 it all unfolds? No. Show me in history where that has happened before. And again, I submit to the hearer, the listener, if you can answer any of the questions that I'm asking or Bill's asking, or you can clear out the confusion in any way, we both have email addresses, Bill's at William Posey at answersfortheparanormal.org, mine Joe at answersfortheparanormal.org. So if you can clear anything up, please feel free to. I've never suggested that none of these questions could be answered. I've never suggested that anything that I say could not be cleared up. I have suggested that they haven't been cleared up and they haven't been answered to my satisfaction. Moving on to page 27, Bill.
Joe, before you do that.
Yes.
Looking at a couple of things here on 26, and they don't really make sense to me, so maybe you can help me. It says, the review of electronic evidence, and there's no further explanation as to what that electronic evidence is. Also found many things that are on a typical hard drive or a memory card. So this, whatever evidence this is, wasn't on a hard drive or a memory card. They said it would be found. It's typical of the things that are found on those two things. So that eliminates them in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
It says it would probably have no relevance to the investigation either because of the creation date or the subject matter. But that being said, the following topics or items were found within the digital evidence seized. So what is this digital evidence? Is this a camera? Is this a camcorder? What? Because he goes on to explain some of the things found. He says 2 videos showing suicide by gunshot, commercial movies depicting mass shootings, a computer game titled School Shooting, where a player controls a character who enters the school, screenshots, and what screenshots are is a screenshot from a computer. All right, so he's saying this was found on some kind of digital evidence, screenshots of an online game called Combat Arms,
right.
Dance Dance Revolution game screenshots, videos of a shooter playing, videos of the shooter playing DDR, images of the shooter holding a handgun to his head, images holding a rifle to his head, and so on and so forth. And your name's about five or six more things. Now,
right.
What is this digital evidence? Shouldn't we know what he's taking all this from? I don't get it.
I don't either, Bill, and the reason that I didn't have that in my notes is that I am not as well versed in electronics and computer evidence and the things that involve hard drives and computers and laptops and towers that you are. So I didn't even add that up here, but yeah, that's a completely valid question. And he doesn't answer that here. That is something that I don't know that in the appendix he didn't answer. If he did, we will certainly bring that to light in a future broadcast. But your question being at the present, I don't know. I don't know. That's a great question. What is the digital evidence? Because when you're talking about videos, that's not digital. That's analog. Videos of shooter playing DDR. Am I wrong or right?
I don't know. I mean, it's so vague as to what it would be. So is the video a reproduction of, in other words, if he's videotaping something, is it a video of a video that he watches on a computer? I don't understand.
I don't know either, Bill. Your frustration is my frustration in that Mr. Sudensky has really crackerjacked this report. And it's inexcusable. I mean, if this is the report of a drive-by shooting at any local city, I would be outraged as well. But when you're talking about something that is watershed in the history of the United States, and you have a crackerjack report such as this, and the appendix is no better from what I've been able to glean, it's inexcusable. It's inexcusable, and it's one of the things that just drives me crazy, and I know that it drives you crazy as well. So, if anyone can answer Bill's question that he just posed, again, if you go to www.answersfortheparanormal.org, which is our website, you will see on what page is it, Bill, that you connect to our email addresses?
Contact
page. Click on the contact page. You can answer the question that Bill just asked. So moving on here to page 27, it's under the same heading that Bill just mentioned, the digital alleged evidence found, the digital evidence seized. And I have highlighted here, large amount of materials on firearms.
Yeah.
This is, again, on page 27. My comment is this. It would appear from this report that the Lange's had what amounted to a small arsenal at 36 Yogananda. Weapons and ammunition everywhere, on every floor of the house, magazines and other materials and firearms. And this is gleaned from the crime scene video evidence from the Connecticut State Police. So the question is, Bill, where did they fire these weapons? In the backyard of their house?
No. Well, no. We were told that it was at a local shooting range.
We were told that. Problem with that is there has been no evidence whatsoever of that being the reality from any shooting ranges anywhere near 36 Yogananda or far. And going back to shooting in the backyard. I mean, if that would even be allowed. But there's no evidence of that from any neighbors saying, oh, yeah, the Lonzo set up targets in their backyard all the time when they were shooting. No evidence of that.
No.
Okay. So did they belong to a gun club? No. No evidence of that as well. So it would appear, Bill, that the Lonzo family owned all of this firepower and never used them anywhere.
Huh.
It makes absolutely no sense to apparently be such gun enthusiasts to the point where it goes far beyond a hobby and not regularly shoot them somewhere. I'm not talking about finding some NRA certificate which may show an occasional engagement in firing your weapons. I'm talking about firing them somewhere on a regular, routine basis. You know what it's like, Bill? It's like somebody, some guy owning five Harley-Davidson motorcycles, and no one ever seeing the guy riding them.
Yeah.
Yeah, the guy's a Harley Davidson enthusiast. You ever see him riding anywhere? No. He just keeps them in his garage. Doesn't make any sense. The whole gun
right.
enthusiast angle is absurd and just doesn't make any sense. Moving on. Page 28. This is under the heading events and background information leading up to December 14th, 2012. Recent background information. This is Stephen J. Sedensky. In September 2012, the mother sought to buy the shooter another computer or parts for a computer for the shooter to build one himself. She was concerned about him and said that he hadn't gone anywhere in 3 months and would only communicate with her by email, though they were living in the same house. The mother never expressed fear of the shooter for her own safety or for that of anyone else. The mother said that she had plans to sell her home in Newtown and move to either Washington State or North Carolina. She reportedly had told the shooter of this plan, and he apparently stated that he wanted to move to Washington. The intention was for the shooter to go on a special school, to go to a special school in Washington or get a computer job in North Carolina. In order to effectuate the move, the mother planned to purchase a recreational vehicle to facilitate the showing and sale of the house and the eventual move to another state. The RV would provide the shooter with a place to sleep as he would not sleep in a hotel. In Sandy in October 2012, with no power in the house, the shooter refused to leave the home and go to a hotel. The mother wanted to buy the shooter a CZ-83 pistol for Christmas and had prepared a check for that purchase to give the shooter. On December 10th, 2012, the mother indicated to a friend that the shooter had bumped his head badly. There was some bleeding, but he was okay. This apparently appeared to have occurred at 5:30 a.m. She then prepared for her trip to New Hampshire and cooked for the shooter before she left, leaving them his favorites. Okay. My comment to all this ridiculous nonsense. This is
oh, my goodness.
My comment is this, Bill. Now, how is it possible that you will not include in the report 9/11 calls or eyewitness testimony from those present in the classrooms that morning, as Sedensky stated earlier in this report, but you do include this irrelevant hearsay?
Boy, isn't that the truth?
Point, Bill, of including a potential home sale or a potential move to another state or plans to buy an RV because Adam won't sleep in the motel or that there was a check made out for a firearm or that Adam bumped his head or that Nancy cooked Adam's favorites before leaving for a trip. This is all nonsense and adds to the overall ludicrous nature of this entire report.
No question.
It goes towards my statement that this is all agenda-driven. It's all agenda-driven. That's the only reason this would be included in this report, this hearsay. And I'm glad you ended by laughing, Bill, because it is laughable. It is really laughable. Moving on down to page 29. Again, under the heading of general background information. More generally, those who knew the shooter describe him in contradictory ways. He was undoubtedly afflicted with mental health problems. Yet despite a fascination with mass shootings and firearms, he displayed no aggressive or threatening tendencies. My comment. Thank you, Sedensky, for reaffirming the points I made earlier about Adam and the non-relationship between his alleged fascination with violence and that he never displayed any aggressive or threatening tendencies. Those apparently reared their ugly heads all of a sudden on the morning of 12/14/12, if you would believe Mr. Sedensky's report. Okay, and moving down to the bottom of 29, Bill. This is under the general background information of parents.
Mm-hmm.
After college, the brother moved out of state. He reached out to the shooter for a few times, but the shooter did not respond. As of December 14, 2012, the older brother had not had contact with the shooter since 2010. The brother believed that the shooter and his mother had a close relationship. After his older brother left for college, the shooter reportedly became interested in firearms and at one point considered joining the military. Okay, my comment to that is this. The shooter reportedly became interested in firearms.
Yeah.
As according to Mr. Sedensky. Anyone ever testify that they witnessed Adam shooting a firearm anywhere at any time? What's the evidence that Adam even knew how to handle an AR-15 or a Glock 20 or a Sig Sauer P226 or an Ismash Sega 12 or a Savage Mark II rifle? What's the evidence that he had any ability to even handle those weapons? Did any family members or friends give testimony that they witnessed Adam loading and firing any of these weapons ever? I don't know. Is one just assimilated into the ability, Bill, to handle a prodigious weapon like the AR-15? Can you accomplish what we have been told occurred at Sandy Hook Elementary School without ever having any prior experience with this weapon? Well, apparently that's what Mr. Sedensky is requiring that we just accept and believe. And again, let me go back to, I think it is, it's probably both of them. I think it's both of them. Mr. C.W. Wade and Mr. Chris Hernandez, the author, the upholders of truth and justice in the American way in Sandy Hook, who have videos on their website showing apparently look to be young children firing these weapons. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the response to that would be, I don't think this is the first time this child that you're showing in this video picked up this weapon and fired it. They apparently have had some training, as young as they are and as frail as they appear to be. Okay, I didn't see any of them firing an AR-15. If they did, then so be it. They can't just pick up an AR-15 and start firing it. They had to have had prior handling of that weapon before the filming took place, Mr. C.W. Wade. You fraud. Mr. Chris Hernandez, you fraud. Don't tell me that Adam Lanza had experience with these weapons without any evidence, without any testimony from family members or neighbors, that Adam Lanza, this 100-pound, 6-foot weakling, knew how to load and operate and replace clips in the AR-15. Without any prior experience. Don't try to pass that by me because it's a lie. You can't just pick up these weapons and know how to use them. And there's no evidence that Adam Lanza knew how to use these weapons or practice with them anywhere. And again, if there is, then send it to me. Moving on, Bill, page 30. The shooter's father saw him regularly until he turned 18. They would go hiking, play video games and other activities. They went shooting twice.
Huh.
My comment, where did they go shooting twice? Was this verified by anyone? A gun range somewhere? What weapons did they fire? Mr. Sedensky, while it appears that the shooter's mother did volunteer at SHES, Sandy Hook Elementary School, it was when the shooter was a student. There is no indication that she volunteered there in recent years. My comment.
No.
Oh. It only appears that Nancy Lanza volunteered at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Has this been verified by anyone from the school itself or anyone from the Newtown School District? And don't expect me to believe some certificate allegedly found at the Lanza home as shown in the crime scene video. Did someone go on record and verify that Nancy Lanza volunteered at any time at Sandy Hook Elementary School? You can't just volunteer somewhere without some hard record evidence of it.
Joe, when did they move into 36 Yogananda?
Off the top of my head, I don't know.
Do you recall that?
No, I don't know. The year, I don't know.
But they moved there after the separation of Nancy and Peter. Is that right?
You know what, Bill? I should know this. I think that the separation allegedly, according to the story, took place after they were at 36 Yogananda.
Oh.
Yeah.
And they moved from New Hampshire, correct?
Yes.
All right, that's something that needs to be looked into because, all right, if they moved at a certain date and he's trying to say here that she volunteered there sometime in the past but not in recent years.
Right.
He needs to be more specific than that.
No question.
In the past,
no question.
When?
That's a good question, Bill. That's, again, it goes to the fuzzy nature of this whole report, the unspecific nature of this whole report. It's something that I would expect from a first-year law student, not somebody who's handling the worst alleged school shooting in American history. So, yeah, you can't just be unspecific about anything in this report. When did she volunteer there? And again, there is no substantiated evidence that she did volunteer there. Moving on. Still on page 30. This is Sedensky. The mother took care of all of the shooter's needs. The mother indicated that she did not work because of her son's condition. She worried about what would happen to the shooter if anything happened to her. She didn't work because she was worried what would happen to Adam if anything happened to her. Yet, she was okay with leaving the week of December 10th for a trip to New Hampshire, leaving Adam alone until 10 p.m. December 13th. 4 days alone without mom, it's just totally inconsistent and sounds contrived. Sedensky's words. One witness indicated that the shooter did not have an emotional connection with his mother. Recently, when his mother asked him if he would feel bad if anything happened to her, he replied no. Others, however, have indicated that they thought the shooter was close to his mother and she was the only person to whom the shooter would talk. My comment, more contrived sounding material. A page earlier in the report, Sedensky states that Ryan Lanza, the shooter's brother, quote, believed that the shooter and his mother had a close relationship, unquote. Now we're told witnesses dispute that, going so far as to suggest if anything bad happen to Nancy that Adam wouldn't care. Sedensky, the shooter was particular about the food he ate and its arrangement on the plate in relation to other foods. Certain types of dishware could not be used for particular foods. The mother would shop for him and cook to the shooter's specifications, though sometimes he would cook for himself. Reportedly, the shooter did not drink alcohol, take drugs, prescription, or otherwise, and hated the thought of doing any of those things. My comment, again, reportedly, Adam didn't like alcohol or drugs, prescribed or unprescribed. I'll tell you what I get from this little snippet, Bill. And from the autopsy report, that Adam had no drugs in his system or alcohol. This is what I get. It's that mental disease caused Adam to commit this heinous crime. He had no apparent motive. So maybe, just maybe, if Adam had been prescribed some good old-fashioned psychotropic medication, this would never have happened. This would never have happened, Bill.
I didn't look into this, but do we have any other reports of persons that have Asperger's going out and committing murders?
Not to my knowledge, nor autism. Not only that, Bill, I remember and I recall outrage from the autism community, the professionals that deal with those who have been diagnosed as having autism, and I believe as well Asperger's, the outrage that there was a suggestion at the time. I don't know whether the outrage was directed towards Mr. Sedensky, the state of Connecticut, the police, or the media that linked Adam Lanza to Asperger's or autism. And I will quote some doctors. I will give names if people want to do further research into that. But there was outrage that there is no evidence to suggest that anyone who has autism or Asperger's is predisposed to violence, certainly of this nature or of any nature that has been recorded. So the answer to your question is no, that's completely unfounded. Okay, now. Real quickly, we're up to 9 o'clock. We've got an hour and a half live. We've got an hour live. Half an hour live, right?
Half an hour live, correct.
Half an hour live, wow. We're going to need every bit of the next hour and a half to get through this whole thing, at least the report and the police response. So let me move on quickly.
Okay.
Page 31, under the heading People Outside the Family. When the shooter had his hair cut, he did not like to be touched and did not like the sound of clippers, so they were not used much. He would sit with his hands in his lap and always look down, giving one-word answers if the cutter tried to engage him in conversation. Then I have to stop here, Bill, before I comment. When I read this, I remember reading to my kids, Dr. Seuss, I swear, Bill, when I read this, I feel like I'm reading Dr. Seuss. I feel like I'm reading a fairy tale. It is so ridiculous and contrived that I don't even think the mind of Dr. Seuss would have come up with this nonsense. Having said that, let me comment now on the haircut scenario. Mr. Sedensky has painted a portrait of both an introverted recluse as well as someone who liked to dance publicly with others. And, Bill, we're going to get to that in a bit. And here we are expected to believe that Adam Lanza doesn't like to be touched and doesn't like the sound of clippers, but either he chooses or himself or his mother insists Adam go to a salon to get his hair cut. It makes zero sense. Adam or his mother would simply have purchased a wall hair trimmer or a pair of hair cutting scissors so that Adam wouldn't have to go through the trauma of having his hair cut. Moving on. Again, under the heading of people outside the family, those who worked on the property at 36 Yogananda never entered the home. They spoke with the mother outside in the yard or at the bottom of the driveway. They were instructed never to ring the doorbell and to make prior arrangements before using power equipment, as her son had issues with loud noises. Okay. No, my comment. No worker ever entered the house? Okay, so Nancy and Adam did all of the painting in the house, any electrical or plumbing repairs, repairs to appliances, any carpentry that needed to be done. I tell you, Bill, it's truly incredible that investigators were never able to find anyone who was ever inside the house. And I understand this kind of scrutiny is going over a lot of heads. And this kind of scrutiny has never been done as far as I've heard. But these are the questions that come to my mind as I read this report, because my mind works logically as well as supernaturally. From viewing the police video of the inside of 36 Yogananda, this is my comment, of 36 Yogananda, the house looks well-kept, Bill, and neat. Really, nothing that would elicit embarrassment. So what was it that kept Nancy from ever letting anyone inside? And, you know, and can I, if I could, I would scream this, Bill, all right? Adam didn't like loud noises, Bill? Gun range? Hello? Weapons? Hello? Workers were instructed to ring the doorbell and make prior arrangements before using power equipment, as their son had issues with loud noises. Apparently, he didn't have the problems with loud noises as far as firing guns.
Yeah.
No, unless you
first thing I thought of.
Yeah, unless you want to believe that every time he went to a gun range, even though we have no evidence that he ever went to a gun range, he was wearing earplugs. Okay. If you have issues with loud noises, you don't even get involved with guns. You know, at some point you have those earplugs out of your ears and somebody else is shooting at the fire range. It's a completely inconsistent portrait of Adam Lanza that has been painted by Mr. Sadensky and the media. It's absurd. Moving on, under the heading of shooter's interests. Over the years, his hobbies included building computers, writing poetry, and hiking. The shooter worked briefly at a computer repair shop. When he was younger, he played the saxophone. The shooter had a cell phone but never used it. My comment, the hiking thing doesn't ring true, Bill. For someone who allegedly placed...
Who's a recluse?
and for someone who allegedly had placed black plastic over their bedroom windows, and as you said, Bill, as a recluse, to be out taking in nature is just utter nonsense. And what were the circumstances of this brief job at a computer repair shop? How brief was the time he worked there, and why did he leave? And who was his boss? Who was the owner of that shop? You mean to tell me that he wouldn't have searched somewhere?
Where was the shop?
Where was the shop? You know how people are, Bill. They like to get their name in print. They like to become famous. It's amazing that no one has come forward and said, you know what? Adam worked at my computer repair shop. Let me tell you my experiences with Adam. Never happened. And in the age of information, baloney. That's a friggin' lie. It's a lie. Moving on, Sadensky. Shooting was a pastime in which the family engaged. Over the years, the shooter enjoyed target shooting and would go to a range with his brother and mother. The mother had grown up with firearms and had a pistol permit. The shooter did not. Both the mother and the shooter took National Rifle Association NRA safety courses. The mother thought it was good to learn responsibility for guns. Both would shoot pistols and rifles at a local range, and the shooter was described as quiet and polite. My comment again, Bill, no local shooting ranges have ever confirmed that any of the Lonzes at any time ever shot at their range. The NRA has stated that there is no record of any Lonza either registering for one of their courses nor obtaining any certificate of achievement. Again, if somebody wants to correct me on that, some shooting range from Connecticut, somebody who's aware of one, you email me, give me the name, give me the shooting range, and I will contact them and try to confirm it, okay? But until then, nothing has surfaced that would validate Mr. Sedensky's claims that they shot at local firing ranges. All right, check this one out, Bill, okay? You want to talk about simple? You want to talk about simple? Just give me simple 101 evidence, Mr. Sedensky. Bottom of page 31. Initially, the shooter did not drive, but he eventually got a driver's license, and the Honda was purchased for him. The shooter was issued a driver's license in July 2010. My comment, anyone ever seen Adam Lanza's Connecticut driver's license?
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think this would have turned up somewhere, Bill?
You would think.
Since there are so few photos of Adam, his license photo would have surfaced somewhere, wouldn't it? Not have? This is absurd. This is ridiculous.
Well, Joe, as far as I would understand, it would still be in some archive in Connecticut, whatever their drivers.
Yes.
Department of Motor Vehicles would be.
Correct.
They would have an archive of his driver's license, including the driver's picture.
Right. A driver's license in Pennsylvania, as far as I'm aware, is public record, and it's available to anyone. So, if anyone can produce Adam Lanza's Connecticut state driver's license, please send it to me, and I will verify it with Connecticut State Department of Transportation. Moving on to page 32. Oh, actually, continuing from bottom of page 31, Bill. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know what? Why don't you cue up our song, our intermittent song of the night?
Sure. All right, here goes. Feel like dancing, Joe.
Yeah, that was Leo Sayer from the 70s. You make me feel like dancing. And I don't think Bill is as fond of the 70s music, certainly the pop music, as I am. So I actually do like that song. I get the feeling that you don't like that song, Bill.
It wasn't on my regular playlist, no.
Well, let me give a little introduction here. Let me explain a little bit. I think levity is okay in a situation such as this. As we were talking before we went on air, Bill, I don't believe there's any evidence to suggest that 20 children and 6 educators died that day. There's no evidence whatsoever that's produced that would convince me of that fact. And so going on that premise, I can have Bill play a song by Leo Sayer, You Make Me Feel Like Dancing, as we enter the next segment of absurdity in Stephen J. Sadensky's report on Newtown, Connecticut, 12-14-12. I'm going to say here from Mr. Sadensky at the bottom of 31, his words, the shooter liked to play a game called Dance Dance Revolution, which is a music video game in which the player stands on a platform, watches a video screen, and moves his feet as directed by the video. A home version of this was seen and photographed in the shooter's home. Several videos of him playing DDR, Dance Dance Revolution, were found on digital media taken from the home. The DPS found in the home and reportedly belonging to the shooter indicated that he regularly went to the area of a theater that had a commercial version of the Dance Dance Revolution game in the lobby. In 2011 and up until a month before December 14, 2012, the shooter went to the theater and played the game. He went most every Friday through Sunday and played the game for 4 to 10 hours. An acquaintance of the I'll comment on that, Bill. An acquaintance of the shooter from 2011 to June 2012 said that the shooter and the acquaintance played Dance Dance Revolution quite a bit. They would play the game and occasionally see a movie. They did not play first-person shooter games at the theater. The shooter had stamina for DDR, Dance Dance Revolution, never appeared winded unless really exhausted. Okay, let me indicate that the theater that they're indicating here would be the Lowe's Theater in Danbury, and I'll comment on that as well. Here's my comment to that. We have the portrait painted here of Adam Lanza thus far by Mr. Sadensky's report, and it just doesn't jive with Adam becoming John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever on the weekends. Let's say he played this home version of the DDR, Dance Dance Revolution, at home. Okay, let's see one of those videos of Adam dancing just to help me believe he even existed. Just show me that video, Mr. Sadensky. Put it out there somewhere. Somebody out there break the law and give me that video. Put it on YouTube so I can see Adam Lanza playing this DDR game to verify that he was a real person. Now, you want me to believe that he went, quote, most every Friday night through Sunday and played the game for 4 to 10 hours. This is totally, totally absurd. Dancing for 4 hours straight, let alone 10 hours straight? That's what the report says here, Bill. I have to read it because it's clear. The shooter had stamina for Dance Dance Revolution and never appeared winded unless really exhausted, according to this acquaintance, quote unquote, who we never have substantiated. This statement is completely lacking any sense. So Adam just danced away until what? Exhaustion immediately brought him to his knees. He's dancing to this game, and then bang, exhaustion hit him. Stamina up until a certain point, and boom, he's down, and somebody's got to drag him off this DDR floor. What about others who would have witnessed that Adam Lanza playing DDR at this theater, the Lowe's Theater in Danbury, Connecticut? Wouldn't they have come forward to give him their story?
Mm-hmm.
Come on. Come on. And how in the world has this acquaintance of the shooter of allegedly the worst school shooting in United States history, managed to remain anonymous. So somebody's got to explain to me how someone can dance for 4 straight hours to this Dance Dance Revolution game, 4 straight hours, so an hour, a half hour dancing straight. I'm reading word for word here. I'm reading word for word. 4 to 10 hours every Friday through Sunday. Four to 10 hours. Even if someone wants to say, okay, so he danced a little bit, then he got off the floor, then he got back on, then he got off, then he got on, then he got off. Give me a break. That's just as absurd. And no one
Joe, I probably should have got a hold of Michael Jackson's Dancing Machine and played that too.
Yeah, Adam Lanza would have had to have been a dancing machine. This is just, I mean, it's just ridiculous, but I have to read it because it's here in the report. This is under the heading, moving down to the bottom of page 32. The following background, down a little bit further. The shooter went through Newtown Public School System, through part of 7th grade and part of 8th grade. Though part of 7th grade and part of 8th grade were done at St. Rose of Lima School in Newtown. My comment to that is, I have never seen any evidence that Adam Lanza ever attended St. Rose of Lima School in Newtown. Although I know the church exists, I've seen it. You've seen it in person as well, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if someone wants to send me that evidence that he did attend that school, either someone from St. Rose of Lima School itself or someone else who has access to that information, please feel free to send it. And again, we will forward that information on to our listeners in a future Blog Talk Radio broadcast. Moving on to page 33 quickly. Again, still under the heading of a shooter, education, and mental health. While the shooter did attend Sandy Hook Elementary School from 1998 to 2003, the first through fifth grade, I want to stop there. My comment is I have never seen any evidence of documentation that Adam Lanza ever attended Sandy Hook Elementary School. Did you, Bill?
No.
No, I haven't. Okay, moving on. Sadensky, he was never assigned to the classrooms where the school shootings occurred. My comment. Huh? Okay, then, yeah. What classrooms was he assigned to? And who were his teachers? None of these teachers have ever commented about their experiences of having Adam Lanza as a student. And don't you think they would have at some point? Or we to believe that all these people are so saintly and so well-meaning that they just don't want to even comment on this Adam Lanza. You know what? Cut me a break. People sell their soul to the devil all the time, either for fame or for money. So somebody would have surfaced and said, yeah, I had Adam Lanza in first grade. Here's what he was like. Moving on. Sadensky, the shooter went for walks with his family around and near Sandy Hook Elementary School after he had gotten out of the school. My comment. How is this known? Walks around and near Sandy Hook Elementary School? There's no sidewalks except for the very center of Sandy Hook. You have Riverside Drive, where the firehouse is located, which would be dangerous to go for, you know, just a stroll, since the road is rural with many curves, and there's also Route 34, which is the same. How would this have been known?
So did they drive from the neighborhood where they lived into Sandy Hook and then go for a walk?
They would have had to, Bill.
Because Yogananda's not that close to...
No, it's not. No, it's not. It's about, I think, 3 or 4 miles from Sandy Hook Elementary School.
Mm-hmm.
This is all supposition, and, you know, again, I ask, how is this known? You can't just say what you want to say, picture, or to further an agenda. You have to have some evidence to back it up. I don't care who you are. If Mr. Sadetsky thinks he can get away with this pablum, he's wrong. He's gotten away with it for the most part, for 99.9% of America. But there's a small segment of the population that knows this is a bunch of crap. Mr. Sadetsky, page 33 still. As he got older, his condition seemed to worsen. He became more of a loner. As the shooter got into the high grades of middle school, he did not like noise and confusion and began to have issues when he had to walk to different classes. My comment. And yet we're supposed to believe that Adam went to the local theater and danced the night away. And by the way, the nearest theater to Sandy Hook that would have possibly been is the DDR video game, 10 miles away, Bill, in Danbury.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't like noise and confusion, and he had trouble finding different classes in middle school, and yet we're told he liked to go hiking where you can easily get lost. He didn't like noise or crowds, and yet we are told he went to a theater to play Dance Dance Revolution in an environment where you have loud kids and video games. It just doesn't add up. This doesn't pass the smell test. Give me a break. Mr. Sadetsky, he attended Newtown High School with a combination of homeschooling, tutoring, and classes at Newtown High School and Western Connecticut State University. My comment is I have never seen any evidence or documentation confirming there was ever an Adam Lanza that attended Newtown High School or Western Connecticut State University. If I'm wrong about that, somebody send me the invitation, the information. I don't want to continue to be wrong about that. And if it is verified, don't just send me and think that I will swallow it hook, line, and sinker. I will attempt to verify it. And if it turns out verifiable, I will correct myself on a future broadcast. Okay, still on page 33, and I'm going to try to go real quick here. In the 2002-2003 school year, when the shooter was in fifth grade, he was quiet, reluctant, very bright, and had good ideas regarding creative writing. He wouldn't necessarily engage in conversation, but wouldn't ignore one. There was no recollection of him being bullied or teased. Keep that in mind. I moved down to point five. That was one. In the fifth and sixth grades from 2003 and 2004, the shooter participated in concerts at school. He was not remembered by the teacher as having been bullied, and the shooter had at least one friend. Point six. He was a normal child with no oddities. There were no reports of bullying or teasing. Point eight, one person who remembered him from middle school never saw the shooter bullied. Okay, my comment on that is this. It seems an attempt is being made here to emphasize, Bill, that Adam Lanza was never bullied or teased.
Mm-hmm.
My thinking here is that they want you to believe the issues which caused Adam to go on a murder spree were gun-related and mental health-related.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, Adam Lanza didn't commit mass murder as revenge for being bullied or teased.
Mm-hmm.
It was because guns were available to a mentally unstable 20-year-old. That's what the report is being suggested. That's what the report is suggesting. Point nine here. In seventh grade, the teacher described the shooter as intelligent but not normal, with antisocial issues. He was quiet, barely spoke, and did not want to participate in anything. His writing assignments obsessed about battles, destruction, and war far more than others of his age. The level of violence in the writing was disturbing. My comment, the emphasis here is that Adam, antisocial, with an obsession for destruction and war. My thinking here, Bill, is that they want it in our minds to consider that there are ticking time bombs in our schools.
Yep.
And we better start thinking about doping them before they explode. And, oh, yeah, make it almost impossible for them to get their hands on a firearm.
Mm.
Point 10 from Mr. Sedensky. In the 9th and 10th grades, the shooter is reclusive, shutting himself in the bedroom and playing video games all day. Point 11. In high school, the shooter did not have good social skills. My comment, yeah, I'll tell you, but darn, Bill. Get Adam Lanza on the Dance Dance Revolution dance floor, and he becomes Tony Manero from Saturday Night Fever, man.
Uh-huh.
Forget about those awkward social skills and that reclusiveness. Just get him in front of that video screen, and bingo, bingo. Maybe that should be the answer. Instead of doping people up, put Dance Dance Revolution in every school, and
there
this will help. There, this will help kids who have antisocial and who are contemplating mass killings. Maybe this will help in some way. Okay, here, moving on. Point 12. In high school, the shooter would have episodes, quote unquote, and his mother would be called to the school. The episodes would last about 15 minutes each. There were no signs of violence during any of these episodes, and the shooter was more likely to be victimized than to act in violence against another.
Hmm?
And down at Mr. Sedensky's footnotes here, point 49, what these episodes were was unclear. And my comment is that you state here, and it seems important enough to include in the report, that
right.
Adam's episodes were so concerning that his mother would be called to the school, and it sounds as though this would have occurred multiple times, and yet you are unclear as to the nature of these episodes. It makes no sense.
Mm.
What were these episodes, these nonviolent episodes?
Yeah, in which others victimized him instead of the other way around.
Right, right.
But he wasn't teased or bullied.
Yeah, right. Okay, point 14. He was not remembered to have been bullied or to have spoken about violence. Again, Adam wasn't bullied. It's about guns and mental health. Take care of these two issues, and
mm-hmm.
we will stop school shootings and stabbings, apparently. Point 15.
Right.
Mr. Sedensky, the shooter had a LAN party, capital L-A-N, which means it's a party where attendees eat pizza and play video games. The shooter had a LAN party at his home in 2008 with tech club members. No firearms were seen at the shooter's home. How the heck they would have known that? I have no clue. Okay.
That's hilarious.
So, yeah, so my comment is no one ever stepped foot inside the Lanza home except, oh, wait, the pizza party and video party where no firearms were seen. You know what the translation is, Bill? The guns were hidden. And if we take away the guns, they won't be able to hide them until someone goes berserk and shoots up a school or a movie theater. You see, you really have to think through what is being said here. Not everybody's a dope who's worried about the World Cup and worried
mm-hmm.
about the NHL draft and the NBA draft and who's going to win the Super Bowl. Not everybody just cares about frivolous things like that, Mr. Denton. Some of us actually out here actually pay attention to details and read between the lines and can see what you're saying here. And I know that you know that we know. And apparently you don't care or your bosses don't care and your bosses' bosses don't care. But that doesn't mean you're not going to be exposed at some point. And so move on to page 35. Mr. Sedensky, in the school setting, the shooter had extreme anxiety and discomfort with changes, noise, and physical contact with others. My comment, but guess what I'm going to say, Bill? He seemed to be cured once you got him to a noisy movie theater to Dance Dance Revolution with his acquaintance.
Hmm.
That was the cure for Adam. Okay. Now, I'm going to give out some names here because it's in the official report. And amazingly, you know, why they redact so much, Bill, and yet give these doctors' names out, I don't know. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm not smart enough to know, but here we go. It was reported that his school issues related to his identified emotional and or pervasive developmental disorder, that's PDD, spectrum behaviors, his high level of anxiety, Asperger's characteristics, obsessive compulsive disorder. Okay. Those names are here, Bill. These are questions that I have answered, that I asked, that I didn't know, but now I know. Dr. Paul Fox, medical doctor on 9505, diagnoses Adam Lanza with Asperger's disorder. And that's Sandy Hook Report, Book 8, Document 00179889. Dr. Robert King on 102406 states to Peter and Nancy, quote, Adam appears to fall somewhere in the pervasive developmental disorder or autistic spectrum disorder, Book 8, 00179815. 12106, Newtown High School psychologist Michael Ridley concludes, quote, there is no evidence of a specific learning disability and that Adam's issues relate to his identified emotional and or PDD spectrum behaviors. And on 2707, Kathleen Koenig, advanced practice registered nurse at Yale Child Studies Center, diagnoses Adam Lanza with obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. So anybody who wants to do some further research into those individuals, please feel free to. And if you come up with anything, let us know.
Mm-hmm. Joe, we're coming to the end of our live stream tonight. And so I wanted to take this time to thank those who tuned in to listen live tonight to Sandy Hook on Trial, the final chapter. And we will be continuing into the third hour here, and it will be available on a podcast. So you'll be able to hear what Joe and I will be saying in the third hour. And as we continue on in the report from Stephen Sedensky. So thanks for listening tonight. And again, we want to just give you our website real quick, www.answersfortheparanormal.org. And our email address is joe@answersfortheparanormal.org and william@answersfortheparanormal.org. So slip us a note. Let us know what you thought about tonight. And if you have any information that would update any of the questions that we had regarding the things that we brought up tonight, please, please, please send us an email and we'll be expedient in replying to you. So again, thanks for listening and have a good night. All right, Joe.
Yeah, moving on here, Bill. We're still on page 35. Mr. Sedensky writes in his report, tutoring, desensitization, and medication were recommended. The shooter refused to take suggested medication and did not engage in suggested behavior therapies.
Mm.
Okay, so my comment is, you see? Adam Lanza refused the medication and behavior therapies, Bill.
Yep.
Now, if we can only find a way to force medication and therapy to those we think may be a threat,
mm.
You know, Bill, that's the agenda. That's the agenda. Moving on here. Mr. Sedensky. Over the years, his mother consistently described the shooter as having Asperger's syndrome. She had a number of books in the home on the topic. She also described the shooter as being unable to make eye contact, sensitive to light, and couldn't stand to be touched. Over time, he had multiple daily rituals and inability to touch doorknobs, repeated hand washing and obsessive clothes changing to the point that his mother was frequently doing laundry. And a footnote here from Mr. Sedensky. This included not opening doors for himself because he did not like touching the door handle or other metal objects, often going through a box of tissues a day to avoid contact.
Mm.
Okay, so my comment on that. So how did Adam get into the movie theater to play Dance Dance Revolution? Did his acquaintance open all the doors for him?
I'll go you one further, Joe.
Yeah.
How did Adam get into classrooms 8, 10? Those doors were closed, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point, Bill. Didn't like to touch doorknobs. Luckily for him, they could only be locked from the outside.
Yeah.
They were open. And we'll get to that as well. But getting back to this, did this acquaintance acknowledge this at some point that he had to open the doors for Adam Lanza? I don't see that anywhere reported. Lanza sounds like he would have been very content living in a plastic bubble, Bill. But this report would have me believe that he went to this theater with all of its metal door handles for more than a year. For more than a year.
Mm.
All right. I want to try to move real quickly to get through this in an hour, Bill. I don't see how we're going to be able to do this, but let's just try. This is on page 36 under the firearms and related evidence heading, history. The shooter did not have a permit to carry a pistol, nor had he ever had one. His mother had a valid permit. Now, my comment is that we've been told that Alonzo loved firearms, Bill, and that shooting was a pastime in which the family engaged, according to the family here, meaning Nancy, Ryan, and Adam. You know, I find it highly curious that since firearms and shooting were so highly valued and enjoyed that only Nancy would have ever legally purchased any weapons, Bill, including, as we were told, the AR-15, the AR-15, the Sega 12, the 12-gauge shotgun, the Glock 20 10mm, the Sig Sauer P-222, the B-226, the 9mm, and the Savage Mark II 22 caliber long rifle. Why wouldn't Ryan Lanza have purchased a firearm at some point?
Mm.
Federal law states anyone aged 18 can purchase a Title I rifle or shotgun, and anyone 21 can purchase a handgun. So why would Nancy have made out a check to Adam for the purchase of a C-183 handgun when he couldn't legally purchase the weapon until he turned 21? 4 months later, Bill. Why not just write him the check then for the gun birthday? Why do it at Christmas?
Good question.
Yeah. Okay. This is under firearms recovered bullets and fragments. Recovered from the shooter's Honda Civic outside Janie Hook Elementary School. Ismash Sega 12, 12-gauge semi-automatic shotgun. The Ismash Sega 12 was found in the shooter's Honda Civic that was parked outside Janie Hook Elementary School. It was tested and found to be operable without malfunction. There was no physical evidence indicated this weapon had been fired at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Bullet fragments and extended shell casings recovering at the scene and from the office of the chief medical examiner could not have been fired from this weapon. Okay, so my question is, why would Adam Lanza bring this shotgun to the school if he didn't intend to use it? Why leave it in the car? He used the AR-15, the Glock, and the Sig Sauer. Why not the Ismash Sega 12 shotgun? And let's remember, Bill, the rifle allegedly was found in the Honda Civic's passenger compartment and moved to the trunk by a police officer. So it's not as though the weapon was always in the trunk. So someone can't say, oh, well, that shotgun was always in the trunk. That's why he didn't bring it in school. No, this was found in the passenger compartment in the front of the car. So why wasn't this brought into the school? I'm going to move on here to I'm making some determinations as I look here, Bill, in consideration of time, what to move on to.
Okay.
One of the things that really ticked me off about this report, it's on page 38. It's under the heading Miscellaneous Investigative Leads. Sedensky writes this: in the course of the investigation, law enforcement personnel received a large number of contacts purporting to provide information on the shootings and the shooter. This applied to both state and federal law enforcement. Information that was substantiated and relevant was made part of the investigation. Other information after the investigation was not substantiated. Typically, someone would call the Connecticut State Police and leave a message that they had information relevant to the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School. In an abundance of caution, a detective was assigned to follow up on every lead, regardless of its presumed validity. Some of the more than 40 unsubstantiated leads and information are described below because of their nature or mention in investigation documents. Okay, I want to stop now. Now, Mr. Sedensky is including this in his report. My question is why? If these leads were determined to be unsubstantiated, my question is why? I want to answer my own question. It's to further an agenda. It's to further paint a picture of Adam Lanza that they want us to believe about Adam Lanza. It's a means to an end. And although these leads were determined to be unsubstantiated, therefore it wouldn't be admissible in any court of law, and so stated by Mr. Sedensky himself here in the report, yet he somehow finds a way to include it in this report. Gee, why is that?
Yeah.
Let me read one, Bill. Let me read one. And people that are listening will get the gist of it. Investigators determined that on 12-12-12, 2 days before the alleged event at Sandy Hook, an individual logged onto a website called 4chan.com and anonymously posted, quote, "I'm going to kill myself on Friday and it will make the news. Be watching at 9 a.m., unquote. Another anonymous individual asked, "Where at?" quote unquote. The first individual responded, "I live in Connecticut. That's as much as I'll say." So this is determined to be an unsubstantiated, Bill. Why would this be included?
Yeah.
Other than it points to, hello, this would be Adam Lanza, right?
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's unforgivable of Mr. Sedensky to include this in the report. It's hearsay. And again, by his own words, unsubstantiated. But to my point, he's including it in here to further an agenda. That agenda is to get us to believe that Adam Lanza, this Adam Lanza that they've painted was responsible for 12-14-12, end of case. All right, let me move on here. I have to mention this, Bill. This is, again, under the unsubstantiated leads. Point three, Dick's Sporting Goods. Police received a lead that the shooter had tried to buy ammunition at Dick's Sporting Goods store. Store security surveillance videos were recovered and reviewed. Down to point seven. Connecticut State Police investigated a lead that the shooter went to Newtown High School before going to Sandy Hook Elementary School. In the course of this investigation, one parent refused to let her high school child be interviewed by police and related that a friend of the child had told the child that they saw the shooter in the parking lot before the shooting. A review of Newtown High School video did not substantiate this claim. My comment. So I guess there was a different security company that installed this security system at the high school because the one at Sandy Hook Elementary School did not record. And going back, the Dick's Sporting Goods store security surveillance videos were recovered and reviewed. So you have a sporting goods store that has a security surveillance video system in place that can be reviewed, but an elementary school with alleged state-of-the-art surveillance equipment doesn't. And let me further add, Bill, last weekend I was in the Pocono Mountains of the state of Pennsylvania, the beautiful Pocono Mountains. We stopped at an ice cream stand. There was a sign above the area where you bought the ice cream that there was a surveillance video system in place that anything done against the law was being recorded. And I thought to myself when I read that, people buying ice cream are being recorded, and yet a state-of-the-art security surveillance system at Sandy Hook Elementary School does not record. You know, this is where I want to scream, Bill. This is where I want to scream. How dumb do you think we all are?
Right.
You're lying. You're lying, and we know you're lying, and you're hiding the truth in plain sight, and we know it. All right, I'm gonna go on to the last page here, Bill. The conclusion of the report. I'm gonna go on to the conclusion of the report because I think we've got about a half an hour. Whatever I can get through, I'll get through. This is in Mr. Sadetsky's conclusion to his report on page 43. Many people have asked why the shooter did what he did on December 14, 2012, or in the vernacular of the criminal justice system, did he have a motive to do what he did? This investigation, with the substantial information available, does not establish a conclusive motive. What we do know is that the shooter had significant mental health issues that, while not affecting the criminality of the shooter's mental state for the crimes or his crimes responsible, his criminal responsibility for them, did affect his ability to live a normal life and to interact with others, even those to whom he should have been close. Whether this contributed in any way is unknown. The shooter did not recognize or help himself deal with those issues. He had a familiarity with and access to firearms and ammunition and an obsession with mass murders, in particular the Columbine shootings. There is no clear indication why Sandy Hook Elementary School was selected other than perhaps its close proximity to the shooter's home. What is clear is that on the morning of December 14, 2012, the shooter intentionally committed horrendous crimes, murdering 20 children and six adults in a matter of moments with the ability and it. Bill, what is that banging? You hear that?
No.
You don't hear banging? It sounds like somebody's banging pots and pans.
Oh, jeez.
You don't hear anything whatsoever?
No, I don't hear anything, Joe.
All right. I'll try to move on here. I'll pick up. What is clear is that on the morning of December 14, 2012, the shooter intentionally committed horrendous crimes, murdering 20 children and 6 adults in a matter of moments, with the ability and intention of killing even more. He committed these heinous acts after killing his own mother. The evidence indicates the shooter planned his actions, including the taking of his own life. Now, here's the paragraph that I want to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
It is equally clear that law enforcement arrived at Sandy Hook Elementary School within minutes of the first shots being fired. They went into the school to save those inside with the knowledge that someone might be waiting to take their lives. It is also clear that the staff of Sandy Hook Elementary School acted heroically in trying to protect the children. The combination saved many children's lives. And that is the conclusion of Mr. Sedensky's report. Now I want to comment on that. And it's a 1, 2, 3, 4, it's about an 8-page comment. If we can get through it, Bill, in half an hour. When Mr. Sedensky talks about the heroism of the first responders that day, actually, and who knows why, the first Newtown officer, McGowan, arrived not at the school, but on the street behind the school,
right,
Crestwood Drive, at 9:39, exactly. The first to arrive on actual school property were Newtown Sergeant Colgren and Officer Chapman at 9:39:13. And this is all from the auxiliary to this report. Colgren and Chapman parked on the driveway near the ball field, a good 500 feet or so away from the front entrance to the school. Now keep in mind, the first 911 call to Newtown Police came in at 9:35:39. So the shooting has now been going on for at least 3 minutes and 21 seconds, and the officers had to be aware of this. So let's do a quick recap. Shooting has been going on for 3 minutes and 21 seconds at least, and the first officer arrives on the street behind the school, and the next officer is parked 500 feet away, and these officers report hearing gunshots upon their arrival. Okay, it's now 9:40 exactly, 4 minutes and 21 seconds after the first 911 call to Newtown. Everybody's reporting hearing gunshots, and still no officers have even attempted to enter the school. Let's remember we're talking about an elementary school, Bill, with children as young as 5 years old. The last gunshot is reported at 9:40:03, believed to be the suicide shot. 9:40:05, Officer Penna arrives and parks behind whoever, it's redacted, so it must be a civilian. And Penna runs through the woods to the front of the building. And my response is, huh? Okay, it's a more direct route. If you know the landscape of Dickinson Drive and the school, it's a more direct route, but you have to traverse through woods rather than just running down Dickinson Drive. You have to traverse through woods, so it's going to take longer. 9:40:15. Newtown Sergeant Bahamonde arrives and parks behind Colgren. Bahamonde runs to the front of the school and meets up with Newtown Lieutenant Vangeli and Officer Penna in front of the school. At this point, Sergeant McGowan is busy arresting Chris Manfredoni on the east side of the school. Now, again, we have to remember the absurdity of Chris Manfredonia's actions. He's there to help his child build gingerbread houses. And he's on the east side of the school, which I'm looking at the layout of the school here, Bill. The front of the school is on the north side. So Manfredoni is running along the east side. So why is he not, if he's so concerned for his child, going into the gaping hole in the front of the school? You know, he if he hears shots, like we brought up on the last broadcast, and smells sulfur, he's not familiar with the school. He's running around to the east, southeast side of the school.
Right.
Where it's already locked. He would have known this. The doors would have been locked. He wouldn't run to the front of the school. So that's the absurdity of Mr. Manfred Downey's actions. Now, 9:41:05. Officer Seabrook meets up with Vangeli at the intersection at Church Hill Road and Connors/Wire Road. Now, the problem with this here is that we have already been told that less than a minute earlier, Vangeli was in front of
the school. Yeah.
With Penna and Bahamonde. And Connors Wire Road is at least a mile from the school. So how can this Lieutenant Vangeli be in two places at once?
Wow.
9:41:24. McGowan says he needs to help to secure Chris Manfredonia by the playground. So now Chapman and Smith respond from the south side of the school. Colgren responds from the north side of the school. Newtown Chief Kehoe and Captain Rios respond from Crestwood Drive, which, by the way, is adjacent to the playground, so Kehoe and Rios must have seen McGowan.
Right.
Seabrook arrives from his meeting with the twin of Vangeli. I say the twin because he has to be twins, and proceeds to the east side of the school. 9:42:27. Seabrook enters Dickinson Drive. The problem here is a few sentences earlier, we were told that upon arrival, Seabrook proceeded to the east side of the school. So why does he go all the way around to Dickinson instead of simply going directly to Crestwood Drive? Oh, well, at least he didn't run through the woods like Penna did. Okay. I'm still hearing that banging, though. Are you hearing it?
No.
That's incredible. How is it possible that I can hear it and you can't? I'll be interested to hear whether this shows up on the
when we listen to the podcast.
Okay. Moving on. Now, on the east side of the school, on the playground, we have McGowan, Chapman, Smith, Colgren, Kehoe, Rios, and Seabrook. Seven cops for Chris Manfredonia, who Bill might by this time must have morphed into the Amazing Hulk.
Right.
Where you need seven cops to subdue this guy. 9:42:39. Panic calls out plate number on the Civic, this the Honda Civic in front of the school. Now, I'm wondering why neither Penna, Bahamonde, or Vangeli noticed the large gaping hole in the plate glass window, since we were told earlier in the report that they had a powwow in the front of the school. It's incredible to me that you have all these shots reported, a broken out window in the front of the school, and these officers are running around in playgrounds, running around the dumpsters. This is obscene.
It is.
And people who are listening to me commenting on this report are going to have to go back to it because I'm going through it real fast. You might not get the gist of what I'm saying at first, but when you do your own research or just listen to what I'm saying and go back and look at the appendix report yourself, you'll see exactly what I'm saying. 9:42:47, Vangeli and Seabrook arrive at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Vangeli drives toward front door and Seabrook parks in the Sandy Hook Elementary School parking lot. Problem here is we were told earlier that at 9:40:15, Vangeli was with Penna and Bahamonde at the front of the school. So when did Vangeli really get to the school? And we were also told that Seabrook had already arrived on Dickinson 20 seconds earlier, 9:44:33. Activity is observed at the front door of the school, believed to be Newtown officers. Chapman and Smith complete a check of the perimeter. Chapman and Smith make eye contact with McGowan at the rear of the school, and then they go back to the front door. 9:44:50, Colgren, Seabrook, and McGowan break a window on the southeast side of the school and enter a door. Okay, Bill, let's refresh. First 911 call to Newtown was 9:35:39. It is now 9:44:50. And the first entry by law enforcement since arriving at 9:39 exactly, 5 minutes and 50 seconds later, 5:50 exactly, Bill, almost 6. We have other officers witnessed by the custodian of the day, Rick Thorne, enter the lobby of the school at 9:45:02, a full 6 minutes and 2 seconds after arriving at the school. These are Vangeli, Bamandi, and Penner. They gained entry not through the gaping hole in the front of the school, Bill, but went through the boiler room and into the kitchen on the northwest side of the school. I can hear some saying, well, they didn't want to disturb evidence by coming through the hole. You know what? That's baloney. This is an elementary school where shots have been reported for over 10 minutes. Time is more of the essence here than it would be under any other circumstances, and it's certainly more important than preserving evidence. So at this point, officers can't know that the shooter has allegedly taken his own life. And surely there are wounded. But instead of going right into the school, you have 10 Newtown officers playing musical chairs outside the school. I want to know if any of these officers have ever come forward and admitted their unmitigated, miserable response to this situation and their cowardly response. Let me again say, cowardly response. If this was a real event, 10 minutes after the shooting starts and you're running around the school when you got an open hole 3 foot high by 3.5 foot wide that you could have gone in. So considering the timeline I just went through, Bill, Mr. Sedensky's assertion that they went into the school to save those inside with the knowledge that someone might be waiting to take their lives is very misleading, to be kind. It took the Newtown police more than 6 minutes to get to the area of the blown-out glass, the gaping hole next to the front door where obvious entry was gained by the shooter. So please, Mr. Sedensky, can we get some honesty somewhere here in this whole Sandy Hook story, please? Moving on. At 9:46:48, Connecticut State Police Sergeant Cario and Lieutenant Davis arrive at Sandy Hook Elementary and immediately enter the school through the broken window. So don't try and tell me there was a concern for preserving evidence. These guys, according to the report, went right in. The first concern is preserving lives. Trooper First Class Kick. Quote, this is Connecticut State, Trooper First Class Kick. Cars coming in. Set up a four-corner perimeter around the building. Okay. Unknown where the shooter is. Set up a four-corner perimeter around the building. 10:08:37. Trooper First Class Keene, quote, Troop A, have the fire department close down the road. We don't have any police personnel to do that. What? Huh? No police personnel to close off one road, that would be Dickinson, from Riverside Road to the school. Bill, at this point, there were 20 Connecticut State Police on the scene and 13 Newtown. 33 law enforcement officers altogether. So how is it that they were unable to take a few of those and close off the only entrance to the school off of Riverside Road?
Right.
Especially since you don't know if there are multiple shooters. Connecticut State Police Lieutenant Davis. Quote, just be advised, we may have two shooters and we may have a suspect vehicle that they may have pulled up in. Connecticut 872, Yankee, Echo, Oscar, Black Honda. Unquote. So again, you have all these officers that are aware of aware that there are maybe possible multiple suspects, and yet the civilians are allowed in the parking lot to just stand around, which we see in Shannon Hook's photo, allegedly taken at 10:09. Wouldn't it be possible that one or more of these civilians may have been involved in the shootings? And we're not going to be able to get to that tonight, Bill. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm going to put that on the blog because that's critical. 10:21:50, Connecticut State Police Lieutenant Davis. Quote, we're all set up with Connecticut State Police personnel perimeter and inside. If any other people are coming, we just need them for the mess outside with the parents and the kids. Unquote.
Mess?
Again, possibility of multiple shooters. And Lieutenant Davis says there's a mess outside with the parents and kids. Why would you allow any more civilians onto the school grounds? You're chasing potential suspects through the woods and on playgrounds, but yet you're allowing civilians to camp in the parking lot? Bill, at this point, I have to point out that as of 10:23:58, there are still large groups of teachers and kids being let out of the school and apparently civilians in the parking lot. And yet we haven't seen one scrap of civilian cell phone video or pictures of this massive extrication from any surrounding surveillance videos of the businesses that are proximate to the school. 10:23:14. Connecticut State Police Delvecchia. Quote, 034 to a Troop A. We got the area cordoned off so no vehicle can get out as well. Unquote. 10:23:22. Connecticut State Police Desk Man Loomis. Quote, Roger, 034. Unquote. Okay, so here we are now about 53 minutes after the shooting started, and we find out here that no vehicles can get in or out. We were told that Sandy Hook Fire Department arrived at 10:08:52, almost 39 minutes after the shooting began, and staged in the northeast portion of the school parking lot. Keep in mind, Bill, Sandy Hook Fire Department's driveway on Dickinson Drive connects to the school. It's about 1,100 feet away, yet they didn't get into the parking lot until 10:08, 39 minutes after the shooting. Why? Wasn't it safe? Well, there were a bunch of civilians in the school's parking lot this whole time. It must have been safe enough for Connecticut State Police and Newtown Police to let them hang around. So why not the Sandy Hook Volunteer Fire Department?
Mm-hmm.
And the vehicle that they're talking about here, Bill, is not an ambulance. So far, the only mention of officers with any medical training arrived at 10:08:49, 39 minutes, Bill, after the first shots rang out. And these would be Trooper First Class Fountain and Trooper First Class Poach, members of Emergency Services Unit. It doesn't say here that they have any life-saving equipment with them, Bill. It just says that they arrived.
Right.
And at 9:51:28, Connecticut State Police Detective Dragon arrived on the scene and ran to the front of the school with his medical bag. Okay. So if that was your child, Bill, and you have these two emergency services troopers, not paramedics, not doctors, and you have a guy showing up with his medical bag, how would that make you, what would come to your mind if it was your child?
Yeah, they're the... He's there to assist.
I tell you what would come to my mind, Bill. Give me a first responding paramedic in that school. I don't want some trooper first class who is a member of the emergency services unit. And again, it doesn't say that he has any life-saving equipment. I want paramedics in that school to see if they can bring someone out, save somebody's life, save my child's life. I don't want some detective showing up with his medical bag. And you mean to tell me that you don't have any, not one lawsuit against this school district or against the state of Connecticut? That's bull. They didn't do everything they could. If this was a real event to save those kids' lives, two guys from the two troopers showing up or members of the emergency services unit and one guy showing up with his medical bag. Thankfully, this is the last page, Bill. We're going to be able to do it. Now, people really have to really listen to what this – they've had to listen to all of this. There's so much to reflect on here. But if you haven't listened up to this point, if you're dozing off, listen to this. You will understand after I read this page that this is a hoax. This is a lie. It couldn't have happened. You will understand it. By the appendix report of Mr. Sadetsky himself, you will understand that Sandy Hook didn't happen. It's a lie. 10/29/17. Connecticut State Police Sergeant O'Donnell tells Connecticut State Police Dispatch that they had completed the first search and are now conducting a thorough second search. Connecticut State Police Sergeant O'Donnell, quote, got the cleaner's set of keys. We're going through unlocked closets looking for young children that might be in there, secure. So we're doing that right now. And then we are going back around. We're going to do another whole perimeter, and we're going to do another search of the entire building systematically again. 11/39/49. Colgren, quote, S6 to headquarters. State police SWAT team is searching school inch by inch right now. We have K9 assisting, unquote. 11/31/19, Bahamonde, quote, I am in the school and can confirm that the school has been checked three times over and they are doing a fourth.
Wow.
Bill, we are now 2 hours into the event. Three searches have been conducted and the fourth is underway. And with K-9 assistance, How did Sarah Cox and Barbara Halstead manage to stay hidden in the nurse's closet until 1:15, Bill? It's a miracle.
Another hour and 45 minutes, right?
That's right. Four searches, including a K-9, and they can't find two women. They're hiding in the nurse's closet. Now, if someone wants to tell me that they still believe this story, you know what? Go ahead and believe it. I don't care anymore. If you want me to believe that four searches were conducted of the school, and I hope that Chris Hernandez, the author, is listening, this guy who has had law enforcement training, this guy who was in Iraq, who told me, who asked me, oh, I bet you've never searched a school before, when I asked him how was it possible for them to evade a search for almost 4 hours. And his ludicrous response, oh, I bet you've never searched a school before. There's plenty of places to hide. And they were scared and they didn't come out. You want me to believe that four searches were conducted, including with dogs, by SWAT teams, inch by inch, and these women stayed in this closet for almost 4 hours in an elementary school? It's a square, Bill. This school is a square.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have a lot of nooks and crannies, like Paul Vance said. So this is impossible. And I don't have to look at anything else other than this last page. You people are liars that these women were hiding in this closet for four searches.
Mm-hmm.
I have one more paragraph here. Paragraph, Hildo. 10-29-05. Sandy Hook Fire Department establishes a perimeter of cones to keep bystanders back. An hour after the incident began and someone, the fire department, not the police, Bill, is finally thinking it might be a good idea to keep the public away from a mass murder scene. What, the Connecticut State Police or Newtown didn't have any cones? And here's the last comment. 11:36:15. Newtown Lieutenant George Cinco responds to Sandy Hook Elementary School. By the way, Mr. Cinco is no longer with the Newtown Police Department. And a number of others in this whole drama have disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
But Mr. Cinco at that time, now I'm hearing some interference, Bill. You hearing this?
No, I'm not catching anything.
Cinco responds to Sandy Hook Elementary School from his private duty assignment at Monroe Newtown Line on Route 25. 2 hours later, Bill, 2 hours later, 11:36:15.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, this event wasn't serious enough for a Newtown lieutenant to leave his private job for 2 hours. Figure that out. Or maybe Mr. Cinco knew that it wasn't real.
Mm-hmm.
Just throwing that in there. So we were able to get through all that, Bill, and we got about 15 minutes left.
Amazing.
And again, let me repeat that I have some very, very significant information, so much that I wasn't able to get to tonight, that I'm going to include in my future blog, my near future blog. And Bill can give out that information, how you access that as we end the program.
Sure.
Well,
Joe, it's been an amazing 2 3/4 hours. You know, to get through all that you needed to get through tonight, and to paint a picture that, is there anyone really who questions this anymore? After all that you heard tonight, after all the explanations that
mm-hmm.
the Connecticut state attorney tried to give for the reasons that the supposed shooter, Adam Lanza, carried this out. And then to listen to Joe read from Connecticut State Police, Newtown Police, their actual reports as their radioing back and forth between command posts, Is there any question that this was a drill at best? But if you have anything contrary to that, if you have information that points to the official story as Connecticut State Attorney Stephen Sadensky says it happens, please send it to us. Again, our website is www.answersfortheparanormal.org. Our email address is joe@answersfortheparanormal.org. Mine is william@answersfortheparanormal.org. And as Joe stated, he will be blogging more of the evidence that he's researched and found, and he's going to be presenting that on our blog, and you can access that at www.answersfortheparanormal.blogspot.com, or you could even go to our contact page, and there'll be a link right there that will take you to our blog. And so with that, we want to wrap up the show the same way that we began the show tonight, and that's with the gospel, the good news of salvation that is available through Jesus Christ, our Lord. And, you know, Joe began the broadcast tonight reading from the book of Hebrews and telling that the blood of bulls and goats and the sacrificial system that was set up in ancient Israel was just a picture and a foreshadowing of what would happen when Christ took on flesh and came to this earth. And it was his sacrifice, the shedding of his blood, that would pay the debt for the sin of mankind throughout all of history. And so we want to begin tonight by just showing from the scriptures how we all have a sin debt that needs to be paid. When our first parents, Adam and Eve, were in the garden, God had commanded them that they were free to eat from any tree that is in the garden except the tree that is in the middle of the garden. And he told them that the moment that you ate of it, you would surely die. And then we find in Genesis chapter 3, we have a person who comes onto the scene in the form of a serpent. And he has this conversation with the woman, and he says to her, has God really said that you can't eat from any of the trees in the garden? And she responds to him, no, we're free to eat from any tree except the tree in the middle of the garden. And she says, we can't even touch it, because if we do, we will die. And the serpent answers her and says, you won't surely die. And he goes on to intimate that God is hiding something from both Adam and the woman. And he tells them that when they eat of that fruit, that their eyes would be open and they would be like God. And so the woman sees that the fruit is good. And she takes the fruit and eats of it. And there with her in the garden is her husband, Adam, and she takes some of that fruit and gives it to him, and he eats. And the moment that they do that, their eyes are opened, and they realized that they're naked, and they try and take some fig leaves and put together some covering for themselves, and they go and they hide. Because coming through the garden, walking in the cool of the evening, is God himself. And he's calling out to them, where are you? And they respond that they were naked, and so they hid. And so God answers them, well, who told you that you were naked? He says, did you eat from the tree that I commanded you not to? And they go on to admit that they did eat from the tree. Adam blames his wife. His wife blames the serpent. And it's there in the garden that God comes out and poses the curse on the serpent. And he curses the ground, and the perfection of creation now produces thorns and thistles. And he goes on to tell the woman about, because she was deceived, that she would have pain in childbirth. And then he tells Adam, because he listened to his wife, that the ground is now cursed and he would have to work it all the days of his life. And then he tells the both of them that they were no longer able to be in the garden, that he was going to make coverings for them from animals. He would cover them and then he would send them out of the garden. And he would post an angel at the head of the garden with two flaming swords so that they could not make their way back to the tree of knowledge. And what this does is it all points to the fact that when God told them that the moment they ate of that fruit that they would surely die, that they died spiritually. They died because they were now separated from God. They no longer had access to him in the garden. And so the spiritual death that began when they disobeyed God now brought about physical death, because Adam and the woman were created to live forever. And so this threat of physical death is something that the enemy of our soul, Satan, has been able to hold over mankind. And so it was because of Adam's sin that he now became separated from God.
Mm. Yes.
And it would be all those born of Adam who would also be separated from God and then would become guilty sinners. Because when we all would examine ourselves against God's perfect law, we find that we fall short. We miss the mark, which is what sin is. Sin is lawlessness. Mm-hmm. See, we all disobey God's commands. And so we become guilty sinners. And so we're in a hopeless situation because of our sin. We can't make our way back to God the same way that Adam and the woman couldn't make their way back to the into the garden to have communion with God. And so mankind is separated from God because of his sin. And the wages of sin is death. But God, in his infinite love and mercy and wisdom, provided a way for mankind to come back into communion with him. And it was not by any effort of mankind themselves, but it was only through Jesus Christ, through the God-man who would come to this earth. And Joe's going to tell us what Jesus has done for mankind, the way that the first Adam brought death into the world, the second Adam, the second man, would bring life. So, Joe, you take it from there.
You know, Bill, I think that many, many would be familiar with the scripture that is found in John 3:16. You often see that held up at sporting events where we can read from the third chapter of the Gospel of John 3:16. But I tell you what, there's scripture that follows right after that that is should be known as well as John 3:16. And after I read it, we might understand a little bit better. Let me read from John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. And then in verse 17, we read this. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. So as Bill, you correctly from Scripture painted a picture of man's fallenness and his inability to be right with God through his own efforts, through any effort of his own, and that it is only by a perfect sacrifice that we can be brought back into a reconciliation with a holy God. Sin has separated us, and the reality of the penalty for sin is so horrible that many churches today don't even talk about it. Many churches don't even talk about it. If someone dies in their sin, and this is what we gloss over nowadays, if someone dies in their sin, they're lost forever. They're lost forever. There's no such thing as purgatory where someone can go and be prayed out of this temporary place of suffering as the Roman Catholics teach. That's a lie. It's not true. It's not scriptural.
Mm-hmm.
When you die in your sin without Jesus Christ, you are condemned forever. You are judged forever. You are punished forever. There is no coming back. My mind can't contemplate that. My mind can't get around that. It tells us in Revelation that ultimately we wind up in the lake of fire, not hell, but hell and Hades. Hell and death give up those that are held in them to be delivered